of Texas A&M University, the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology brings you the Sports Medicine Podcast. Our mission is to make sense of and connect the science, practice, and application of the latest findings in sports medicine and human performance to the real world. Here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Hello and welcome to the weekly podcast from the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance. We are so glad that you joined us this week. Every week we bring you leaders from sports medicine and exercise science from around the world. This week we are so pleased to have Dr. Larry Kinney with us. Dr. Kinney is a professor of physiology and kinesiology in the Knoll Laboratory at Penn State University. He has a long list of accomplishments. Actually, it would take us the rest of the podcast for me to tell you all the things he's done. I've been honored to know Larry for more years than either one of us wants to remember. But in particular, one of his big achievements, he's past president of the American College of Sports Medicine, and he has provided leadership in exercise science nationally and internationally for many years. He, in particular, also his research that we're going to talk about today is funded by the federal government through the National Institutes of Health. And in particular, he's had one grant funded since 1987, which is a big deal in the science world. So welcome to the podcast today, Larry.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a little warmer here today, isn't it, than from where you're at?
We had 4 inches of snow in State College, Pennsylvania on Saturday,
wow.
But quickly melted, and we're back up into the balmy 50s.
Wow. Yeah, welcome back to the balmy 50s, huh? So tell me a little bit about them. What's the main focus of the Knoll Physiological Research Center at Penn State?
Knoll Laboratory, which is no longer called the Knoll Physiological Research Center, was the first freestanding building in the country dedicated to education of applied physiology students, people who work in exercise and environmental physiology.
Yeah.
The building was built in 1972. Mm. Through the work of a very famous physiologist who just passed away recently named Dr. Ellsworth Buskirk. And it's a very unique facility because we've got a tremendous opportunity to do all sorts of environmental and exercise physiology within the building without leaving. We've got 4 environmental chambers, one of which is an altitude and hyperbaric chamber.
Mm.
We can control heat, cold, wind, radiant heat. We've made it rain.
In the building?
In the building, in the chambers.
Usually that's not something that you want to do, right?
It's usually not a good thing, but we've done work for companies like Gore, testing Gore-Tex clothing, and DuPont testing some of their clothing and footwear. And so we've made some messes in the laboratory, but it's a unique facility because we can simulate almost any environment that people exercise in on Earth.
Well, most of your research has dealt with thermoregulation, how humans deal with heat and cold, and in particular, you've worked with aging populations as well. What do you see as the biggest challenge for, especially the elderly, in hotter environments?
Global warming as a phenomenon isn't a big deal for humans because the average temperatures on Earth are changing.
Mm.
It's a big deal because as the average temperatures change, that increases both the frequency and the severity of heat waves.
Mm. Mm.
And so during these large environmental heat waves that everybody has read about, especially over the past 10 years or so.
And experienced.
The majority of people who die, in some cases up to 90 or 95% of the mortality during heat waves are people over the age of 65.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And interesting to us, and what forms a lot of the basis of our research, is that they don't die of heat stroke. They die of cardiovascular problems.
Wow.
As the body tries to adapt and compensate for the environmental heat load.
Yeah.
So they tend to die of myocardial infarctions. They die of congestive heart disease. They die of all these problems that the heat puts as an extra burden on the heart and causes it to work harder to pump blood to the skin.
So they don't necessarily die of heat stroke and some of the other heat conditions that we think of, but those things are affecting the cardiovascular system.
That's correct. Their body temperatures go up, but in many cases in the elderly, they have a compromised heart function that in some cases they knew about and it just makes it worse. In other cases, it was never diagnosed, and then it's in many cases a sudden event.
Mm. So does aging affect other parts of the thermoregulatory system? I mean, you've talked about the cardiovascular system, but does it talk? You know, sometimes I hear that older individuals don't feel the need to drink mm-hmm. as much. I mean, does it affect thirst and so forth?
Aging, as you would guess, affects almost every part of the physiological system. And because our ability to regulate our body temperatures is so multifaceted, mm-hmm. and it involves maintaining body fluids, the cardiovascular system, sweat glands in mm-hmm. the skin, hormonal responses, it really does affect all of those systems.
Mm-hmm.
But in this 20 or 25 years of research that we've done on aging and temperature regulation, one of the things that we've tried to do is to delineate the effects of primary aging from all the other things that happen as we age.
Mm-hmm.
For example, sedentary lifestyle that leads to lower cardiovascular fitness levels and leads to situations of lower heat acclimation levels.
Mm-hmm.
Decreases in hydration state, effects of medications. So we started off 25 years ago thinking, oh, older people have more trouble regulating their body temperature and the heat because they don't sweat enough.
Mm.
It turns out that what predicts how much we sweat is much more a function of heat acclimation, aerobic fitness level, and hydration. And once you match people for all those things, there really isn't much of an aging effect.
Hmm.
But where there is an aging effect, no matter how fit you are, is the way the blood vessels of the skin age.
Hmm.
And that's the second prong of that,
yeah,
that ability to regulate body temperature. You need to pump lots of blood to the skin, and then you need to activate sweat glands and have that sweat evaporate.
That's why I get red in the face when I exercise in the heat.
At your age, yes. And that's
blood going to the skin, right?
Correct. And so we've been very interested over the past 10 years in how the heart pumps blood to the skin.
Yeah.
And then how skin blood vessels change as the skin ages in allowing the skin to dilate in the heat and constrict in the cold.
Mm. So as they get older, do they lose that ability to dilate in the heat?
As we age, not only is the ability to dilate in the heat reduced, but the ability to vasoconstrict the skin to stay warm in the cold is also reduced. Mm. And all those changes occur through a variety of different mechanisms that we're just starting to uncover.
Yeah. But you don't hear about cold-related deaths as much as you do the heat-related deaths, right?
Well, that's because humans are tropical animals.
Yeah.
So in the heat, we regulate our body temperature through mostly physiological mechanisms. In the cold, we do behavioral things like go inside or put on more clothing mm-hmm. or huddle, you know, put our arms across our chest and shiver.
Yeah.
So there are fewer deaths from hypothermia than there are from these heat-related deaths during heat waves.
Mm-hmm.
But when those occur, they're also typically the elderly. And of course, there's a lot of socioeconomic issues associated with that.
Yeah.
Tends to happen in the poor, the homeless, and so on. But all things being equal, there are also physiological changes in the way our skin ages that make us more prone to hypothermia as well.
Now, we spend a lot of time on this podcast talking about the positive benefits of activity, and you mentioned that a few minutes ago. Is someone who is active on a regular basis, do they have fewer of these types of changes as they get older than people who are inactive?
Aerobic conditioning, aerobic training, has positive effects on the ability to pump blood to the skin during heat stress and the ability of the skin vessels to dilate, whether you're age 20 or age 80. But the range of those responses is much less by age of 80. Mm-hmm. So the simple answer to the question is yes, we can minimize some of those age-related changes by maintaining a physically active lifestyle. But the other side of the coin is for those of us who are exercise physiologists who study things like muscle and bone structure and those sorts of things, exercise is almost always beneficial. For those of us who study skin, the skin ages regardless of the level of activity. And you could even make the argument that for people who have a lifelong history of exercising outdoors,
right,
with exposure to ultraviolet radiation, it makes it worse.
So wear the sunscreen.
Wear the sunscreen.
Yeah.
And stay covered.
Stay covered. So the message is wear the sunscreen, stay covered. But be active.
Good to be active, but prevent UV damage to the skin as much as possible.
Are there other factors that can help offset some of these changes that people can do, other behaviors that they can do? And we've talked about exercise and sunscreen, obviously, but nutrition, or anything else?
That's an interesting area that we're just starting to get more involved in. As I said, one of the things that forms the basis for our research is the fact that older people don't dilate their blood vessels in the skin as much as younger people. One thing we noticed in the laboratory is the people in the age range of 65 to 90 that have the worst skin blood flow responses are those subjects who are taking daily baby aspirin as a cardiovascular disease preventive measure.
Yeah.
And so that led to a whole area of research for us looking at why that might be. And it turns out that the platelets themselves are releasing dilating factors in the skin. We thought that, okay, aspirin makes it worse. What about something like Plavix, which is the number two prescribed drug in the country? And it made it even worse.
Really? Wow.
So there's an example of a couple things that may have overall health benefits, but in terms of blood flow and control of blood flow to the skin, may have negative consequences. There are a couple drugs, though, that do improve blood flow to the skin. And the major one that we've studied is are the whole class of drugs called statins. Statins do a whole host of things in the body, including improving skin blood flow in the aged.
Yeah.
And so there are people out there now who are suggesting, and quite a few and a growing number of people, that not only should people with high cholesterol be taking these drugs, but almost everyone over the age of 50 should be taking them.
So, yeah, you turn 50, you get your card for AARP, and you get your
and a
card
prescription.
For statin.
Right.
Statins. Well, you talk about aspirin and the negative effects. Do you see the same thing with ibuprofen?
No.
Ibuprofen doesn't give you the same negative
effects. No, we haven't tested it directly in this study, but I don't think it would have the same effects because it doesn't inhibit the same pathways.
Interesting. Wow. Okay. So there's a message for our listeners as well.
I'm not saying that, and don't get me wrong. I don't want people to stop taking their daily dose of aspirin that their cardiologist told them to take.
Right.
But there may be some scenarios in which it changes the system in a negative way. And one thing you might think about is, should those people be sitting in hot tubs?
Mm.
Because in our studies, people, elderly people who take aspirin heat up faster in what we use to increase their temperature, which is a water perfused suit, faster than people of the same age and fitness level who aren't taking aspirin.
Interesting. So be careful in the hot tubs.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be a problem during exercise in warm environments, but at least for now, it's a cautionary tale to be told.
Yeah. You've mentioned here, as we've talked, a couple, sounds like fascinating studies that you've done, and I had a great question here from the producers that you know, basically is, given the over 100 articles and books that you have been involved with, the scientific articles that you've been involved with, what experiments have you enjoyed the most, enjoyed writing about the most?
I've enjoyed almost all of them.
The safe response, yes. Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, you and I have talked recently, and I've talked to a lot of graduate students about, one of the things I've enjoyed about my career is being able to balance the basic science work that we do, where we're looking at very small molecules in blood vessels, with more practical, directly applied studies that we do. For example, looking at what chemical protective clothing will protect military people from the threat of chemical warfare while allowing them to be able to dissipate sweat in a desert environment. So we've been able to balance those sorts of practical studies, looking at clothing, looking at heat exchange, looking at hydration strategies for marathon runners, looking at sodium balance with these other more basic approaches.
Yeah.
So in terms of the short-term enjoyment of studies, sometimes those are more enjoyable because you can get information back to people that they can use quickly to make their lives better.
Yeah. What's your favorite experiment you've done? We've all, as scientists, we all have had experiments that we look back on and go, well, that was fun, and there, you know, there's stories that never get put in the literature. What's your favorite experiment story?
My favorite experiments are any ones that I wasn't a subject in because I wasn't either sweating or sitting in a tub of cold water. I don't know. That's a hard question. Some of the clothing work that we've done where we've looked at actual heat transfer through clothing, we've kind of developed a novel approach to looking at what environments are safe versus unsafe to wear certain types of clothing. And in particular, I had an undergraduate honors student work with me. We had done a series of these studies for the military, for Gore-Tex, for DuPont. And the end result of those studies is putting a line on a chart that says below this line, this combination of temperatures and humidities allows this person to keep their body temperature low.
Right.
But if you get above this line, you need to be cautious because their temperature is going to keep rising. Mm-hmm. Well, this student, Tasha Kulka, who went on to physical therapy school, and I sat down and said, we should do this with football uniforms. And so we did a series of experiments looking at various designs and combinations of football practice and game uniforms. What if they're just wearing helmets? What if they're just wearing helmets and shoulder pads and shorts? What if they put on a full uniform? And so we designed, through a series of experiments, a similar kind of chart for safe and unsafe limits for core temperature in those football uniforms. And that chart now makes up a big part of the position stands of the National Athletic Training Association, several state high school associations, American College of Sports Medicine.
Right, right.
So that's something that I think has some utility.
Yeah, there's, speaking along that lines, there's, given the hot summer that we had in Texas this past year, and most of the high school football practices started in 1st of August, and there's now a movement to ban two-a-day practices in high school, and many of the coaches in particular are quite disturbed by that. And they said, you know, they can monitor people fine and they don't have any problems. Where do you stand on this? Should we eliminate two-a-day practice? I mean, the NFL did that this year in the new collective bargaining agreement. Players seem to be much happier about it.
Yeah. I could talk for hours on this topic because I've spent a lot of time looking into it. I was an expert witness in the Corey Stringer heat stroke death at the Minnesota Vikings training camp in 2001, and I've been involved in a variety of ways in high school, college, and that particular NFL heat stroke death.
Right.
We, in 2001, convened the first conference that was jointly sponsored by Gatorade and the NCAA and the College Football Coaches Association to look into this issue. And out of that meeting and over the presumable dead bodies of some of the football coaches in the audience came the NCAA guidelines that are in place today, which say that you have to have a three-day acclimation period where kids can't wear full football uniforms, that there can't be, you can't have two-a-days until I believe it's the fifth day, and then you can't have consecutive days of two-a-days. If you have two-a-days, you have to have 3 hours between the two practices for recovery. Those things went into effect, and the NCAA has now collected data to show that they've decreased the number of heat-related problems since 2001.
Right.
At the high school level, those things are governed by each individual high school association state by state. And some states have just adopted the NCAA plan as it is. Others, as you said, have just ignored it and said, no, we're going to do what we always do.
Right.
And so, you know, there have been so many recent high-profile deaths among athletes, and in particular football players, that people are really starting to take notice, and hopefully the people in positions of authority will start to take notice and put, if not that type of plan, some type of plan into effect, because it's very clear when you look at heat-related deaths in athletes that they almost always occur on the first or second day of training camp when kids aren't acclimated.
Yeah,
they're almost always accompanied by a practice in which at the end of practice, the coach says, okay, we're going to run wind sprints now. Mm-hmm. So you have this tremendous buildup of body heat late in the practice. And they almost always occur in the bigger football players, the linemen, which some people have interpreted as, you know, it's not good to be that big. And the real answer for that is that it's not that they're big, it's that they're the most unacclimated athletes on the field.
They're so it's not that they have more body fat or anything.
Well,
like
adiposity plays a role, but it's actually a relatively small role. And actually being bigger is better in a football uniform where clothing and rigid pads are covering much of the body.
Sure,
what's different about that is the running backs and the wide receivers and the linebackers and the DBs, knowing they're coming to practice, have been out running.
Yeah, they're getting ready. Yeah.
The linemen have been getting ready, too, in air-conditioned gyms where they've been lifting weights.
Yeah.
And so they tend to be the most unacclimated players.
Huh. Interesting. We are. We could stay and talk about this for a long time, but we're running out of time here for the podcast. So as we do with all of our guests, Larry, do you have a take-home message? If the audience is going to remember anything about your what we've talked about today, what do you want them to take away?
I think from the work that we've done on aging and healthy aging as it relates to our ability to adapt to and tolerate heat and cold, I think people need to realize that there are age-related changes that occur.
Mm-hmm.
Many of those occur in the skin, and some of those are not preventable. But there are things that we can do regardless of age to make us better able to tolerate those extreme environments. Things like staying physically active, staying well hydrated, slowly acclimating yourself to heat when the hot summer months occur.
Yeah. Great take-home message. Great take-home message. We want to, as we wrap up here, we want to thank everyone for joining us today and taking the time to download and listen. And if you thought we had forgotten about our T-shirt question, we haven't. We have producer Cheryl here with our question of the week.
What are a few factors that predict how much we sweat?
So be the first one to email us to the email address on the website with the correct answer to that question, and you will receive the one of our nifty Huffines podcast T-shirts. Be the first one in your neighborhood to wear them. We're trying to spread the word about these podcasts. Larry, thank you so much for being here today.
Tim, you're very welcome.
Being with us. And again, I want to thank all of you for being with us this week. And again, join us next week as we bring another leader in sports medicine to your iPod or your other listening device. Until then, stay active and have a healthy week.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Kelsey Sachs and Cheryl Myrick and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sidney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.